Take your time, but our next case is number 17-12826, Rocket Real Estate LLC et al. Versus Lourdes Maestras. Mr. Stabenow, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Your Honors, I represent Ms. Lourdes Maestras. She's a real estate professional here in South Florida, and she had a partnership with her boyfriend, and they had a falling out. This case involves basically that falling out and a single claim under the Stored Communications Act. It's a rare case under Rule 11 where there's direct evidence that the litigant brought the case in bad faith. There was emails when they had their falling out in August where he literally says, I will bring the worst imaginable team of attorneys against you.
Well, let me ask you this. We're reviewing for abuse of discretion in most of the issues that you're raising, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so in today's world, and maybe even in yesterday's world, people often file lawsuits because of personal feelings of animus. But that, in and of itself, is not the only determinant about whether or not a case is filed legally in bad faith, because I may have a claim against X, but decide not to go through with it because I think it might have been an honest mistake and I'm just not going to litigate. On the other hand, if someone has really done me wrong and has shown me animus, then I might say, I'm going forward.
But isn't
the standard whether or not there's an objective, good faith basis for a lawsuit? And wait, let me ask just one more thing, then you can answer it all. And here, with respect to whether certain damages were available under the Act, at the time the lawsuit was filed, wasn't the law unclear in the circuit on that issue?
Well, there's two issues. So the first one you're saying is whether the person's acting in good faith. I believe the standard is ordinary person, whether a reason ordinary person would have brought the case under the similar circumstances.
Well, you can bring a lawsuit for a breach of contract for a dollar. Most people wouldn't bring a breach of contract case for a dollar, but legally you might be entitled to bring a breach of contract case for a dollar. What do you do in that sort of a circle?
Well, I think the matter is under the Walters case, it's a totality of the circumstances, including the tenuous nature under Walters, the tenuous nature of any of the elements or the claim itself. It's one factor. Is like you just said, the damages issue. And I believe under the Diaz case, it doesn't matter that the district courts in this circuit were not clear on whether actual damages were required, because under the Diaz case in this circuit, this court has held that when the plain language of the statute and another circuit have held that actual damages are required, you can't go to district court cases and start saying, well, look, there's these district court cases that we're relying on.
Sure you can.
Well,
people are always trying to push the envelope. And if you didn't allow that, then you would say, oh, once a majority of circuits have spoken, then you can't go into one of the unsettled circuits and advance a contrary position. That's got to be wrong.
But you're ignoring the plain language. You would be ignoring the plain language of the statute, too, Your Honor.
Well, let me give you an example far removed from here, okay? On the criminal side, many, many, many moons ago, every single circuit in the country for decades had ruled that materiality in the mail and wire fraud statutes was an issue for the court and not for the jury. Every single circuit had said that. Supreme Court takes up a case and says, hey, you guys have gotten it all wrong for all these many years. It's an issue for a jury. But it would be hard to say that those defendants who kept pressing the issue, understanding they were foreclosed by circuit law, and I know it's different because it's a criminal case. I know there's no Rule 11 there. But you get the chance to press an unsettled issue within a circuit as long as you acknowledge contrary authority, right?
I I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. I'm just going by this court's decision in Diaz says that if those two factors are present, there's a circuit court out there and there's a statute that's plain language says whatever it says, then the case and its objective standard. Whether now again, that's just one factor though. Again, whether or not actual damage is required. Let's go into this a little further. Let's look at all the factors. Again, emails that say, I'm coming after you and I'm going to crush you financially. Prior lawsuits. Adding the other lawsuit to this lawsuit. And one of the biggest factors I believe in this lawsuit is this. You have a plaintiff-only attorney fee provision, which should require the court to strictly look at this case, because now here you have a plaintiff where there's like, let's bring in our state law claims where we don't have attorney fee provisions. Let's bring them in here. Let's muddle it up. Even though this case, this claim is really no good, we need to go forward on this claim. And if we lose, who cares? They don't get their attorney fees. But if we win, we get ours. So that was the basis why we used, looking at it from a Rule 11 perspective, the only way that you can try to stop someone from going forward with a frivolous claim is under a Rule 11. Because now they've tied in the state law claims. And you're looking at it from that perspective, all the allegations that were changed, the allegations from the state law case, when they said it was a joint venture, they moved it over here. Oh, we're going to call her an independent agent now. We don't want her to be a partner, because if she's a partner, then of course partners have equal access to everything, which would include the email. Oh, let's leave out the fact, reasonable inquiry, Your Honor. There was no mention of any reasonable inquiry by Joseph Alschul, but by the magistrate, which requires them to go in and say, hey, who created this email account? It was undisputed. My client created that email account. And it was also, Judge Kahn said, if she created that email account, that would be a significant factor that would seriously undermine their Stored Communications Act claim. So then what's he do? He says, well, she was kind of like my secretary. Do you share profits with your secretary? Do you have emails that you send to other people saying that she's a partner? That's what the evidence was in this case. All this is evidence in the record. And then you even have where he tells the police, yeah, we were in joint ventures together. All this is before the lawsuit was filed. And those are the things you have to look at most importantly, because after the lawsuit's filed, of course, someone's going to say whatever they need to say to keep that lawsuit going.
Maybe so, that evidence means that you win, but we don't give sanctions to whoever the winning party is. Right?
Absolutely not. You wouldn't give sanction to anyone that just because they win. But from a perspective someone is more likely to pursue a frivolous claim when it's a plaintiff-only provision. They're not likely to pursue a frivolous claim when it's a mutual prevailing party provision. That's my point. You wouldn't do it because you're like, if we lose, we're going to pay their attorney fees. That's what I'm trying to say. That's a seriously big factor in this case. And it also...
What about when there's no fee-shifting provision at all? What's the presumption?
Exactly. It allows the court to give plaintiff their fees.
No. I'm talking about... You say that there's an incentive, or I think you're suggesting that there may be an incentive to bring a frivolous or close to frivolous claim when the attorney's fees only shift one way.
Exactly.
I'm asking you whether you have a feeling about whether or not there's a presumption of which way things go when the claims don't have any fee-shifting provisions at all. Let's say a state law, common law claim where there's no fee-shifting. Where are the incentives there?
If there's no fee-shifting, you don't get fee. You're saying under on a motion sanctions motion?
Yeah.
I don't. Well, I don't think there's any presumption, but on this case, when there is a one-sided fee provision, I think there should be. It should be more highly scrutinized. That's, I guess, what I'm saying, Your Honor, because you're looking at it from the other party's perspective. Again, they don't have anything to lose, and what I'm trying to bring up is it's not just all this circumstantial evidence. This is a rare case where we have direct evidence, where the plaintiff literally says. And the judge quoted that he was going to crush her financially. He was going to bring the worst imaginable team of attorneys. And she was going to spend the next years of her life in courtrooms.
I want to give you the chance to address one of the reasons that the magistrate judge and the district court gave for denying your sanctions motions, which was that you did not comply with the safe harbor provisions of Rule 11?
Yes, Your Honor. I served that motion on Mr. Alsho and his client in December 2015, the minute they filed their lawsuit. I reserved after this court's decision in Vista, where you then made it clear that you needed damages. I served another motion, and after they also didn't disclose any damages, I served another Rule 11 motion in June of 2016. Judge Kahn said he wasn't going to entertain any sanctions until at the conclusion of litigation. What happened was at the conclusion of litigation, I read this rule, the local rule says I have to comply with the attorney fee provision. So I drafted up another motion. I have to state all my grounds in that motion. I attached, Your Honor, both of those Rule 11 motions to my motion for attorney fees. The magistrate then says, I'm gonna treat, and I also separately filed them on a notice of filing. Both of those Rule 11 motions, I filed them separately, docket entry 262. They're both separately filed, and that's routinely done. I cited three or four cases, the Miccosukee Tribe case, which was up before this court just recently in 2017, where that happened. That's what you do. You serve it, and later on, you do a notice of filing. I attached both of them to the motion for request for attorney fees, saying I'm relying on these motions, and also here's all my billing invoices.
You're saying you had given, before you filed your last motion for fees, you're saying you had complied with the safe harbor provision because you had previously served the required notice, and the district court had said, I'm postponing anything about that until the end of the case.
Yes, and I also served a copy of the motion for attorney fees. So I served everything before they were ever filed. So I served the December motion. I served the June motion. I didn't file them because Judge Kahn said, I'm not taking this up to the conclusion of litigation. If I started filing motions, then he's going to say, why are you doing that? I told you not to do that.
I want to ask you one more question related to that because I want to ask your colleagues about this as well. The magistrate judge in the district court also said that even if you had complied, generally speaking, with the safe harbor provisions, the grounds on which you sought fees at the end were not the same as the ones in which you had sought fees the previous two times.
Your Honor, I will say this. In all of the motions, we said that they brought this case for an improper purpose of harassing her until she paid on those claims. And in fact, if you look on the report, docket entry 301, page 13, the magistrate even says, he finds that we brought this, we raised the issue that it was brought for the improper purpose. In my opinion, an improper purpose of harassing someone is bad faith. So I didn't say bad faith. I believe if you bring a lawsuit to harass someone until they pay on another claim, and this court has a case law on that, the Zerweller case, Palladier versus Zerweller case, if you try to basically have someone settle through another case, and there's other cases on it too, Your Honor, where you're saying, how are we ever going to mediate the case? We could never mediate the case because they didn't have any damages. They were trying to resolve another case. And so basically that's the entire point. I hope I addressed your issue, but
you did. But essentially, I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about them.
As far as what they found, if you look on page 13, the magistrate says that we raised that issue. For them to say that we waived it, I've put it in every motion that it was brought for the improper purpose of harassing her. And at no point would I ever say, I don't want to bring that anymore because they're being nice now. I never would waive that issue, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Stabenow, we've got the main part of your argument, and you've saved all of your time for rebuttal. Mr. Altschul.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Joseph Altschul. I'm here on my own behalf. I'm also here with Mr. Robert Rosenberg, who's here on behalf of Eric Romanow. I'll start with just addressing a couple of the points that came up. There was reference to a state court case that's not before this court. I don't believe it's in the record. But, again, you had references to a partnership as being an undisputed fact. That's not an undisputed fact. And there was no findings by the trial court on that issue. Virtually everything he said that he represented as fact is a disputed issue of fact. But I want to address the notice issues that the court brought up. With respect to the order that Judge Kahn entered that talked about coming back at the end of the case. What happened is very early in the case, fairly early, before he had done discovery from Google and Gmail, he made an accusation that Mr. Romanow lied about changing his password on July 29th and August 27th. Mr. Romanov retained me on August 26th. So there was an allegation that he lied, and then he went and amended in his asserted a counterclaim that that I and my client conspired to present perjured testimony backed up by fabricated Google emails that Mr. Romanow had created. Because of that, he filed this omnibus motion to strike. It was docket entry 95. And that's what that motion was about. It was about creating, perjuring under oath about password changes and then creating, fabricating emails to corroborate it.
Mr. Stabenow says that at least one of the two early sanctions motions referenced a claim that your client had filed the claim for purposes of harassment. Is that not accurate?
Mr. Stabenow always said that the case was about harassment. I don't dispute that he said that the case was about harassment. What I look at is what was set forth in the Rule 11 draft motions, the safe harbor, or what was set forth in that motion. When Judge Kahn denied that motion, what Judge Kahn said is you can raise the issue at the end of the case. He didn't say, here's open carte blanche, anything you don't like, because this was a never-ending, rolling circus of accusations of fraud. And once he got the Google document...
By both sides.
Not by both sides, Your Honor.
This case is a disaster.
Your Honor, I agree this
you
case
almost
is...
You almost feel like finding a stake for those that are found in those vampire films.
Your Honor,
Driving it as hard as you can through the middle of the torso of the corpse.
I don't disagree, and I can't get out of this case. When I tried to get out of this case, he opposed me withdrawing from the case. You know, just last week, he subpoenaed me to come testify in the in a different state court case. I can't get away. And so I agree with you 100%, that there is a disaster. But here's what the difference is. If you know, all of the allegations that have been made about me are fabricated allegations. The conversation with my client never occurred. You know, we conspired to commit perjury and to create false documents. The allegations he made are in the court record of the documents that he filed. He filed the documents making this false conspiracy claim and this false allegation. He has filed the documents making each of the false statements that when the court says it's a disaster, it's absolutely a disaster. And practicing law in the South Florida for nearly three decades, you know, I have never seen anything like this and never been subjected to this. But the one thing that I will certainly say is, as counsel tells you, you know, about an incentive where an attorney fee is not two ways, an incentive to pursue a frivolous claim, I have never pursued a frivolous claim in nearly three decades of practice, and I didn't do it here. This claim was not frivolous. Now, this claim had multiple elements of damage to it. Now, when this client came to me, this is not somebody I knew beforehand. I mean, I know that certainly the appellant and her attorney and Mr. Romanow all had some prior relationship. I was the stranger to that party. And when I took this to collect $260,000 and to address real estate issues that were going on between the parties. And it was only through my communication with Mr. Romanow that it became very clear that the appellant was reading Mr. Romanow's emails. And as a result of her reading his emails, the emails between us, information that she couldn't have known other than by reading his emails. And I understand there's disputed issues of fact about that. But as a result of that incident, that's what ultimately led to the recommendation to the client to change his password, that ultimately led to the allegation that he never did change his password and he committed perjury. You know, simply the recommendation that you need to do something with your email because it appears that our emails are being monitored. And he talks about the state court proceedings. Counsel actually used one of the emails in a state court proceeding, one of the emails that was between Mr. Romanow and a third party that his client wasn't copied of, on that they purloined from Mr. Romanow's emails, and they used that to cross-examine a witness in the state court case. So the reason this case was brought in federal court under the Stored Communications Act is because Ms. Maestres was improperly accessing Mr. Romanow's emails, which is exactly what the SCA is intended to remedy. Now, I'd like to point out on that issue...
The district court never got to a finding on that issue, right?
It didn't. The only finding the district court made was on the very narrow issue of actual damages. The district court didn't get to, and the holding was that absent actual damages, you're not entitled to statutory damages. Now, there was a statement by counsel when he was up here before that the issue was unclear by the district courts in this circuit. The issue wasn't unclear by the district courts. The district court was clear. The Vista district court was abundantly clear. And they the district court did a survey and concluded that the position that you didn't need actual damages for statutory damages was the majority opinion in the United States. This panel disagreed with that, the 11th Circuit. Of course, that disagreement came after this lawsuit had been filed. Now, curiously, in none of the motions for sanctions, none of the Rule 11 that he filed before the judgment, did he address the issue of actual damages. So when he talks about the magistrate not properly reviewing his pre-judgment Rule 11 motions, the magistrate reviewed them closely. He stated that he read them very closely. They never addressed the issue of damages. You know, the issue has been thrown out there, you know, certainly to cast aspersion on me, that once Vista was reversed, that I should have stopped litigating that case. And of course, first of all, that ignores the issue that Vista was not only about actual damages and statutory damages, that the Act still permits declaratory relief, such as who owns the website, which was an issue in dispute, the right to continue to access. She argued that Mr. Romano had no right to stop her from accessing. That's an equitable injunctive remedy, attorney's fees, and punitive damages if it's done willfully. All of that was still available, regardless of this court's decision on actual and compensatory damages in Vista. But aside from that, once that case was decided, as you're reading counsel's brief, you would think that it was clear and he brought it up and he raised the issue. But you know what? That issue was never raised. I didn't know about the reversal of Vista until after I'd withdrawn from the case and summary judgment had been granted. He didn't raise it in his motion for summary judgment. He didn't raise it in any of his Rule 11. He didn't cite Vista. He didn't cite the Fourth Circuit case in Van Alstyne. He didn't even talk about the principle of what was at issue in those cases. And then in his reply brief, in response to the answer in summary judgment, when successor counsel, also unaware that case had been reversed, simply made the argument, well, we're entitled to compensatory, even absent actual damages. Then on reply, he came back and cited the 11th Circuit case. And as a result, Judge Kahn addressed that issue and granted summary judgment. There was never the issue raised. What about additional compensatory damages, which are in the record? Things like web hosting and the actions that Mr. Romanoff had to take to try to stop what was going on. That was never addressed or raised by successor counsel. Now, I do have a couple cases of supplemental authority that I would like to provide to the court and provide to counsel. Should I do that after?
If you're going to do that, you need to do it with a 28-J letter so that Mr. Stabenow has the opportunity to respond.
Sure, I'll be happy.
If you want to give him the actual cases today, just as a matter of courtesy, that's great.
Okay.
But file it with a 28-J letter within 7 days.
Okay.
And Mr. Stabenow, you have the ability to respond as well within 14 days, okay?
Today,
so you file by next Friday?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then, well, that's gonna take us into the holidays. You wanna file before or after the holidays? Both of you.
I'm okay either way, whatever the court's preference
is. You're ready to go today?
I am, Judge.
When are you ready to file the 28-J letter?
I'd say a week from today.
Okay, so that's the 21st. Okay, that's a reasonable request. So how about, well, you tell me the day you want, Mr. Stabenow. January 7th. Well, I guess in January, how about January 12th, which I think is a Friday. Okay, how about the 11th? Okay.
Your Honor, I'd like to briefly address two statements in appellant's brief that I think are dispositive on the facility issue, which, you know, is the facility and damages are the two Rule 11 issues. So on the facility issue, first of all, in the initial brief, First, in the reply brief, on page 01, counsel states that the question in this case about accessing a facility the way the appellant accessed the emails is a novel question of law. And that was, of course, made in support of the argument to try and have oral argument before this court. But this court has decided in precedent in the cases that I'll be submitting, in the Baker case versus Alderman, which was also cited in the magistrate's opinion, that Rule 11 is not something that should be used for novel issues and novel cases. And so on that basis alone, that should be dispositive on that issue. Now, also,
let me just say, if the cases that you're sending us were cited by the district court or by the magistrate judge, you don't have to give them to us.
Okay. And that case was, and it was also addressed in the initial brief as well, in the appellant's initial brief, although I didn't cite it in my answer brief. So it's a novel question of law. The second issue is the issue of connection and accessing a facility. And appellant says on page 11 of their brief, they admit that their phone was connected to Romanov's email account, which was on the Gmail facility. So that admission alone, that her phone was connected to that account, connected to that facility, certainly should bring an end to any issue on whether there was an improper access of whether there was an access of the facility. Of course, whether there was authorization was another disputed issue, but the Rule 11 issue that we're here on is whether there was access to a facility. And I think in their brief, they have admitted access by virtue of that statement, just as they've admitted that it's a novel issue of law. Do we have time for Mr. Rosenberg to address the perjury issue, or did I use it all?
You gave him his time, right?
Yeah, yes. Okay, so this is just my time. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. As I won't get to speak again, I would stand on our brief. I would ask the court to affirm the district court, and I also would ask the court to grant our Rule 38 motion that's pending. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Rosenberg.
Was taking notes, and I had intended to stand.
Please speak into that microphone.
I'm sorry. I had intended to stand on my brief. I think it's complete. But I do want to touch base on perjury, because perjury, of course, is defined by statute. And it seems to me that perjury must be evidenced by willful intent to provide false testimony. There's been no finding by the court here on that issue. There's been no finding by the court on any perjury issue. All we have is claims in documents, but we don't have any established perjury. Along with perjury is its almost companion issue in this case, that there's a fraud on the court, an extremely high standard for fraud on the court. There's no record here, and there's no finding of any fraud on the court. I submit to the court there's no basis for finding it. A fraud on the court, and perjury alone is not fraud on the court. That's what I had to say in the perjury issue, and I'm going to stand on my brief. I think I explained it probably better there.
All right, Mr. Rosenberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I would just like to address the notice issue again, because that's an important issue for the that you've brought up. As Mr. Alschul stated, at every stage, I raised the issue of improper purpose for as a harassment. It's in the first paragraph, I believe, of both Rule 11 motions. And I also believe that that is part of the Rule 11, even though they keep saying that the Rule 11 only involves the damages and the access. I believe that because I raised that in the Rule 11 motion, that it was a Rule 11 issue and not just based on inherent power of the courts issue, which is a separate issue on a bad faith. Even though I also believe that using a lawsuit for an improper purpose is bad faith. If you go to Documentary 301, which is the magistrate's report, and you look at page 13, the magistrate acknowledges that I raised that issue, okay, and that I preserved it, that it was raised for an improper purpose. And with respect to Mr. also bringing up that I subpoenaed him in another case, I've subpoenaed him in another case, Your Honor, because his client brought another case against my client, and they list him as a witness. So he leaves those facts out. That's why he got subpoenaed. Same thing he got subpoenaed in this case, because he lists himself as a witness. I have to do what I do.
The difficulty with this case, among others, Mr. Stabenow, from my personal perspective, is that both sides are saying all sorts of things about the other, but there are no findings from the district court as to a fair number of those things. And so when they say you did X and you say they did Y, they're just allegations because the district court didn't have to resolve them.
And Your Honor, a lot of it is actually his admissions and his declaration. Is it good faith, Your Honor? Is it good faith for a plaintiff to say, yeah, I had a strategy to attack, we had a strategy to attack the counsel, and Ms. Meister said I said that orally, but in fact, I put it in an email. But they never produced that email. Where's that email? I'd love to see that email that you sent an email. They sent an email saying they're going to attack the counsel over here. And you say this has been a very heated, yeah, because I've been attacked, and obviously I've filed Rule 11s, but I don't go out attacking someone personally. I'm attacking what they're doing in here. I'm not going back to whether they should have been admitted to law school or not, which is what they've done to me, okay? I'm just talking about what they've done in this case. And he admitted in a declaration that he sent an email, and you have yet to see that email. It was never logged as privileged, and we have yet to see it. That I don't believe is good faith. And so, you know, he's had five attorneys in this lawsuit.
Five
attorneys in this lawsuit. So he brought the team of the worst imaginable team of attorneys. Just see prompts he was going to do. You know, the email, I would just bring up the email that he's talking about. My client printed that before they even had a falling out, because she knew they were going to have a falling out. And the phone access issue, there is a decision right now. This decision in this case basically says, Your Honor, that if Google, if you have a token on your phone that Google sets up where they're going to automatically send emails to your phone, you can violate the SCA just by having that on your phone. That is not you accessing Google. That's what was going on here. My client created the account, so the token was put on my client's phone when she created the account, and the emails continued to come to that account. Even though he was changing ordinary passwords, Google said on their website, ordinary passwords will not revoke that token. And it wasn't until October 29th that Ravenel figured that out, and he goes, oh, I got to remove that. And that's when her phone first said, you need a new password. How is someone going to violate the SCA when they've never even taken any action? All they did was the stuff just kept coming on their phone. And this, I think that this court should address that issue, because that's people are going to be using that this opinion to go after people just because, even though they haven't even done anything, just because they have emails going on their phone. Because, again, this SCA was created, that Stored Communications Act was created, because they didn't want people to go breaking in, like, into warehouses, so you can't go hack into Google. But it's different when you already set it up so that the... Sorry.
I understand where you're coming from, but the merits of this case is not before us, at least not directly.
Well, Your Honor...
And you're asking us to go out and decide an unsettled issue of law in the circuit when the merits of this case have been long closed. We're just dealing with a fee issue now, a sanctions issue.
Yeah, but that was one of the issues, which is whether or not she was accessing, and it's in the opinion, it's in the report, it's in the district court's decision, and it's going to be relied on. And, you know, at this point, Your Honor,
but the district court didn't say definitively anything on that issue, right? It just said that there are cases holding that is sufficient access.
I think the district court got that wrong, because the district court, those cases are saying is that you can use a phone to access Gmail and to hack into Gmail, and you can use a computer to do so too.
I know, Mr. Stabenow, but you might be on stronger footing in asking us to address that pure issue of law if the district court had said, Mr. Romanow is right, and you can impose liability based on that sort of access. But the district court didn't say that. What the district court said is that there's some law that supports that proposition, and as a result, the allegation was legally and factually supportable. It didn't take a stand one way or another on that.
Yeah, it's true, Your Honor. Okay, he did cite those cases. The only thing is, I cited the cases that say that basically there's a footnote in the Kasuga case which says, you know, here's a bunch of cases that say you can't, accessing your own phone is not accessing a facility. That's what the case law was routinely held, and I cited that in my brief. You know, the fact is, right now, Your Honor, they're using Rule 11 motions as a defensive tactic, and if the court doesn't reverse, we're going to go back down, and they're seeking sanctions against me and my client. saying that this is frivolous, that this appeal was frivolous. They're seeking Rule 38 against me, seeking this appeal is frivolous. Your Honor, you have a plaintiff who's basically, he admitted he was going to do this as a personal vendetta. Whether you say it's proper or not, I don't think it is. But the changes in the allegations and all the facts in their totality, I believe at least warrant sanction against the plaintiff himself.
We think we understand your position, and we've taken you over your time, yes, Mr. Stabenow.
Thank you so much for the extra time, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both, or all three of you.